This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Good afternoon to the world. Good evening, America. Good morning, Australia, or whatever your time zone across this beautiful planet of ours on planet Earth. You are tuned in right here, right now, to the People Speak radio show with Steve Johnson. The People Speak show normally airs every Tuesday from 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific and 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS radio network. Anyone can participate in the show with calling questions for our guests toll-free in the United States and Canada on 1-888-429-5471. That number again, 1-888-429-5471. Or you can join us live in the government and politics section of Pal Talk, the largest free chat program in the world, where we have our virtual radio room, the People Speak radio show, that anyone may join to participate in the show. We have a truly wonderful woman and a gifted author on the show today. She's a brave, courageous woman who has lived through some unspeakable hardships, suffered through most awful state and church-sanctioned evil of the 1960s and 70s. She is one tough-as-nails Sheila. We're absolutely blessed to have an Australian icon here at the People Speak show. Welcome to the show, Kate Howarth, ma'am.
Good morning. Good morning, Steve. Good morning, listeners. Thank you for having me on the show.
Now, we'll be talking about your first book today, best-selling award-winning story called 10 Hail Marys, shortlisted for the David Unipon Award and won the Age Book of the Year in Australia for nonfiction. And hopefully we can get you on again so we can spend an hour by itself talking about your brand new book release called Settling Day. Can you tell us how did you get started on compiling all the memories and putting that all into one piece book, which is a compelling book that it is today?
Well, it was, I'm a reluctant, what we would call a reluctant memoirist. I never set out to write a memoir, and my books are memoirs rather than autobiographies, and the difference is that I'm dealing with certain events in my life rather than a full chronological history of absolutely everything I've done. And in both books, both volumes, I was particularly highlighting social injustices. In the first book, the social injustice to tens of thousands of young women who had their children taken under what is now known as forced adoption practices. A fall from a train just before my 50th birthday left me in a wheelchair and unable to run my business. So I made the best of things and started to write the story of my life under pressure from friends. They knew I'd had an unusual life, and I started to do that. And I got to a point where I gave the manuscript to a trusted friend of mine, and he got to chapter 6 and said, "Why have you glossed over your time in a home for unwed mothers?" Because he knew nothing about this part of my life. And I said, "Well, I kept the baby. Where's the story in that?" Being quite flippant and evasive, because I really didn't want to have to go back and address the horrors that they evoked, maybe melancholy for days just thinking about it. And I was in my late 40s, by the early 50s by this time. However, he gave me a link to the transcripts of evidence that had been taken at a parliamentary inquiry in New South Wales, which I put aside for a few years, and I didn't get to reading them until about 2005, when another, a turning point in my life came. And when I read the transcripts, I realised the wrongdoing, and I realised how important my story was, because the inquiry would have left every child adopted through St Margaret's, where I had my son, believing that there were financial and other material options available for young mothers, and therefore they gave their children up knowing those options were available. Well, that wasn't true, and I could blow the whistle on that big time. And in doing so, I hope to, kick up enough dust to get a Senate inquiry or a Royal Commission or a parliamentary inquiry, some discussion going on this, to bring justice to these women and the children that they lost. And that is the end result of what 10 Hail Marys achieved. And for that, I'm very pleased. But gathering up the memories, Steve, was, you know, it wasn't that difficult because I've got a very good memory, but I had to virtually channel my childhood because I wanted the naive voice of young Kate to tell the story. I tried writing it from the adult perspective and it wasn't working. You know, judgment and opinions came in, you know, with a more mature mind looking back. And I really didn't want that. I wanted the reader to get the feel of what it was like to be a young, vulnerable girl in that situation. So I hope that answers it for you. Thank you.
So it was basically the accident that prompted you to start writing.
Yes. Yeah, I'd always, my focus from a very early age was to become a writer. I really focused on that from a very young child. Storytelling, of course, always played big in our lives. We didn't have money for books. There were a few around, but I had a library card from as young as I could get one. But, you know, my career went in a completely different direction and I didn't have the time or the luxury to sit and write a book. You know, you've really got to be dedicated to putting a book out. It's an arduous process. Writing is just rewriting and rewriting. It's a terribly tedious process and it requires a lot of concentration and effort and time. So I didn't have that time to dedicate to writing. But the fall from the train sort of put me in a position where I had to do something else. I couldn't physically run my business. I couldn't get out and about. I was literally housebound. So that's how then I turned that lemon into lemonade and decided that I would write the story. I had no idea at that stage whether I'd actually become a writer and be published, but I certainly started to write, and the end result was I did become published and for, you know, very to my delight, my first book did win a major award, which has spurred me on to do more.
Now, a lot of people simply do not understand that the hardships you faced were not just from the church and state. A lot of it was from your own family and often from the only people you had in your life. Can you expand on what that did to you at such an early age?
Well, you know, as a child, I didn't think I had it tough at all. You know, people tell me my life was difficult, but as a child, I was just flat out living my life. I didn't think of myself as being hard done by. I didn't need to look very far around me to see kids who had it much, much worse than I did. You know, I didn't come from a drunken, abusive family. I wasn't sexually abused as a child. None of the horrors that we know children can be and still are subjected to in our society. But, you know, it's a difficult gig when you come into this world and you don't have parents, you know, and I didn't. I learnt very early in my life that the woman I thought was my mother was not my mother. And so, in other words, my life was parallel to that which subsequently adopted children and even my own son experienced, that you're being raised by people and then somewhere out of the blue you get this revelation that this person is not your mother. And then you'd have to sort of piece your life together. And usually with that information, you're told, as I was, and many adoptees were, and certainly my son was, that my mother did not want me. You know, my grandmother went the next step and said she didn't want me, she tried to kill me. So that's a big number to lay on a kid, you know. So from there then you have to, and I didn't know the identity of my father at all. And I had two names, two possibilities, two candidates, but I then had to go forward without parents. And my grandmother's role was never redefined. I already had a grandmother. I called her Granny, and she was a Wanneroo woman. And, you know, so my grandmother was just somebody that was there. I was on sort of the tail end of this family, you know, like a little, you know, little caboose at the end of a train. I was sort of bopping along and just trying to hang on.
I guess because I've known you online for many years and heard you talk many times, while I was reading your books, I could almost hear you narrating them in your voice to me. They are written in the same way that you talk when you tell a story. That was really delightful for me and gave me such a strong visual image. Have many people said that about you when they've read your book?
Oh, absolutely. I was very flattered, of course, when the promotions came out and they likened the book to the very marvellous book by Frank McCourt, Angela's Ashes. I was more than flattered. But what they were suggesting there is that I'd achieved a style of writing which did speak through the eyes of the child, which of course is very engaging, you know, and I did that purposefully. That was a conscious effort on my part to do that, to sit down and have a really good yarn. What I wanted to do, Above all, I wanted to entertain you, the reader. I wanted to engage you and bring you into the story. So if there was anything in there that helped you just as a reader, you know, I remember a quote from C.S. Lewis, and it sticks in my mind, and I used to have it on a poster note on my computer. We read to know we are not alone. And my book was written to reach out and touch and help hundreds of thousands of young women who had been labelled heartless sluts, who didn't want their children and just completely discarded by society. And I thought that was so wrong and so unfair. So I wanted to let them know that I knew the truth and I would blow the whistle and tell the truth. But in order to get that truth out, it has to be a story that people will read and engage. So that's what I wanted to do. And if I achieve that with you, Steve, as I have done with other readers, then I'm very happy as an author to have done that.
Absolutely. You summed up the Australian feeling, the Australian, the whole Australiana, I should say. You've summed it all up in your book, and there is an overwhelming sense of what it is to be Australian and growing up in the 60s and 70s in that book. So I was absolutely overwhelmed reading it because I related a lot to what we were going through, but I couldn't help but to feel so sad about what you were facing. Every opportunity to blame you or to get in trouble when it wasn't your fault, it seemed to be a recurring theme throughout the book.
Well, you know, and when I look back, I think that that was part of my conditioning and why I stand as strongly as I do today against injustice, why I am such a, you know, enthusiastic fighter against oppression, against the oppressors, because I know what it's like to be oppressed. You know, I know what it's like to have my freedom snatched away from me. I know what it's like to feel almost invaded, if you like, and to be totally powerless. You know, it's a dreadful position. So I have great empathy when I see people in that situation because I can relate to it, particularly as a child.
What was up with that head nun at St. Margaret's trying to force you to give up your child so much? Do you think she was evil or just doing her job, what she felt she was doing was right?
Well, I don't really think she was evil. I don't believe that. I believe that she had a couple of motives there. One, as you can appreciate, the Catholic Church, or society, not just Catholic Church, but society frowned on unmarried mothers. They really did not want to entertain the idea. It didn't accommodate unmarried mothers and hadn't done at all throughout history, certainly in Australia and Ireland and other places where there was a very strong Catholic influence particularly. You know, sex outside marriage, of course, that was, you know, all of that. So Sister Anne was, she found herself in a situation where she fulfilled society's need to hide these girls away, to hide these shameful fallen girls away. And I think somewhere in her heart she thought she was doing the right thing. But where we got into conflict was when I defied her. See, she was a hospital administrator. She was the power supreme. And along comes this stroppy young kid who says, no, I'm not signing that. You're not getting my baby. And I was the first person ever to stand up to her. So it became almost a personal battle between us. And, of course, she was running one of the most, one of the biggest teaching hospitals, maternity hospitals in Australia, huge. And she ran it, she prided herself in running it on a shoestring. Now, you can do that very easily if you've got upwards of, say, 300 girls working in your laundries and kitchens with no pay, and you're not even supplying them adequate food. So she had a dual motive. She was running virtually a sweatshop, and she had all this free slave labour. And at the end of the result, she had a nice little baby to sell.
There's one thing about doing what community standards dictate at the time, about morality at the time and the church standards at the time. And there's another thing about treating people with basic humanity. They didn't seem to have that in them. That's what really struck me.
Well, see, this is an aspect of the book that many people have picked up on, some haven't. My story was akin, I guess, to The Emperor's New Clothes. Because I was so young and naive about the ways of the world, I wasn't, you know, factoring in all the mature adult things, you know, concerning, you know, unmarried mothers and bastards. All I was working on was pure instinct. This was my child. I'd refused to have it aborted, and there were several people that wanted me to do that. I refused an abortion. In fact, I ran away and I hid myself away for 4 months, knowing that by the time anyone knew I was pregnant, it would be too late, and it was. So, and that's when I let my grandmother know that I was pregnant, when I knew she couldn't strap me down to a bed and force me to have an abortion, because I'd seen these things happen. You know, I'd witnessed these as a child. I knew it was a very real danger. So when I was operating on pure instinct, and this baby that I was carrying, that I conceived, it was the first time in my life that I had something I felt no one could take from me. This was mine, and I had a duty to protect it even before the child was born.
One thing that really struck me as well was every time somebody took you in, whether it was a family member or a friend or somebody who would take you into the boarding, you'd eventually get thrown out. Everywhere you went to, they eventually closed the door on you. But what would that do to somebody? That would drive me absolutely mad. How did you maintain your sanity?
Well, I was probably responsible for some of that because I wouldn't take any guff, you know. If I'd been obedient, if I'd been a conformist, if I'd been you know, dutiful and done exactly what I was told, I probably wouldn't have been in that situation. But I didn't. You see, I was a person who knew very early what was right and what was wrong. And because I was virtually homeless from 14 and had to live on my wits and make decisions for myself, which I was way too young really to be expected to make good decisions, but nevertheless, I had to make those decisions. It made me a little bit different from the average 14-year-old. Not many kids leave home at four. Well, my home, I didn't leave home. Home left me. So I didn't run away from home. As you know, the story was that my grandmother just took off to get married and just abandoned us. So, you know, when you've been in a situation, you know, you get a bit streetwise and you stand up for yourself. And, of course, that doesn't sit well with adults who are trying to push you into a box and get you to do what they want you to do. Mm.
The furniture polish story is one that struck out in my mind, where the lady thought the substance on a rag was something else. I won't go into specifics. Does that sum up what kind of experience you've had, though? I mean, the misunderstandings and the false assumptions that you've had over your life?
Well, it certainly sums up the naivety of adults at the time. I'll let the readers know I was living in a boarding house, and this old crone of a lady, Mrs. Gray, and I've always been very fastidious, very neat and clean and tidy, and I particularly loved the smell of polished wood. And I was working in a factory that was testing in a laboratory, and we were testing furniture polish, and it was mahogany. And this bedroom that I was in had this beautiful mahogany furniture. So one day I grabbed an old pillowcase and I polished my furniture with this mahogany polish, which, of course, left a pink residue on the pillowcase. Anyway, when I came home one day after being out to the beach, she confronts me and accuses me of having had a boy in my room. And I was astounded, you know, a boy in my room? Anyway, she said, and she's waving this pillowcase under my nose saying, "I know male stuff when I see it." She thought it was sperm on the pillowcase. So that's how naive she was. And I said, it's pink furniture polish.
How could it possibly be that when it was pink in color?
Well, it could, if you think about it. Take your thoughts a little bit. It's pretty disgusting, but it could be.
Oh. Okay, let's move on. The feelings that I get
see,
when
that
I...
That was out of my realms of thinking at the time. I couldn't understand. I had no idea what color. I had no idea what color sperm was. I had to ask, "Doc, what color is it?" And he said, "It's white." I went, "Oh."
Now, the feelings that I get when I read the book is that the early 60s and the early 70s in Australia, it was a time of rules and policies that really didn't care what effect it had personally on the individual. Do you still see that very much the same today in Australian government policies?
Well, there were policies, there were several levels, of course. There were policies affecting Aboriginal people, but there were also policies affecting women. And women were little more than chattels, and children virtually had no voice at all. You could just be deemed uncontrollable and sent to a home. And there were two tiers. There was in Sydney, I'll deal with what I experienced. In Sydney, there was Bajura Children's Home, and then there was the Parramatta Girls' Home. Now, the gateway to determine which queue you went onto was determined by a virginity test. So that was institutionalized sexual abuse. So at 13, I had to undertake a virginity test to determine whether or not I was a bad girl and going to be sent to Parramatta Girls' Home, or whether I was a good little virgin and I was going to be sent to another home altogether with children, with other kids who had been just disadvantaged by society. So, you know, the laws at the time, I won't use the word misogynist because I don't think it was born out of any hate for women, but there was certainly a discrimination there against women and girls, no question about that, and that follows through right into my adult life.
Mm-hmm. Now, the time you spent heading out bush, riding on your horse Pixie, to me was such a blessing. It was such a relief that finally you'd found some place to get away and experience life and enjoy yourself, and probably the only time in the whole book I felt that you were happy and had some true freedom in your life. Is that what you felt at the time?
Well, it was out at Nudjawalla that I really learned how the other half lived. You'll remember the day I step into this extraordinary living room in this Persian. I mean, these were very, very wealthy people, the landed gentry, and they had this magnificent home out in the outback, like a massive place, beautiful Persian carpets, quality everywhere you looked. And so I remembered, you know, the contrast that between that and where I had lived, where we used to catch the rainfall in saucepans and I had to put a Band-Aid over a hole in the wall between my bedroom and the man next door so he wouldn't perv on me when I was getting undressed. So the contrast was glaring. Of course, then I realised, you know, that my big concern going out there was that my schooling would be interrupted. But fortunately, there was a wonderful man out there, the station manager, who realised I was a pretty bright kid, and he arranged for me to get black fries. And this is when I learned that if I worked really hard for the first 2 weeks with those modules, I could then throw a saddle on my horse and go out droving for the rest of the time.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Welcome back, listeners. You're listening to the People Speak Radio Show on the BBS Radio Network, coming to you live across America and across the world. I'm your host, Steve Johnson, and we're back with our guest tonight. We've got the problem sorted out. She's an Indigenous woman from the western suburbs of Sydney with an absolutely remarkable tale of survival and struggle with her two amazing books that are Ten Hail Marys and her new book, recently released in March this year, called Settling Day. Welcome back to our Kate Howarth, ma'am.
Thank you, Steve. I'm sorry. Sorry, room. I'm afraid it's mea culpa. I was the source of the difficulty there, so we've got it fixed. Thank you.
Fantastic. Go ahead.
Steve, I was just going to pick up on a question that you asked me if you would like me to answer it concerning the stolen generation and the forced adoption practices. There is a vast difference. Concerning the stolen generation of Aboriginal children, laws were passed in the early 1900s that allowed for the removal of mixed blood Aboriginal children, in other words, half caste or quad caste or all the other runes that they had for mixed blood Aboriginal children, in other words, not full blooded kids. to be removed, and it was quite legal for them to do it. They didn't need anyone's permission. They didn't need the mother's signature. All they needed to do was identify that that there were light-skinned children living in Aboriginal communities, and they could just come and take them. And, of course, that story has been dealt with in rabbit-proof fences. But that's something that we light-skinned Aboriginal people lived with right up until the laws were repealed in the 1970s. Now, the difference here with this forced adoption is that laws were passed in, there was a Child Adoption Act of 1939, which clearly stated that before consent for adoption can be taken, the mother needs to be advised of all of the financial and other material support that's available to her to raise the child on her own before consent for adoption could be taken. Consent shouldn't be taken until 5 days after the birth of the child, and then there was a 30-day revocation period. Well, you'll recall that I was asked to give my consent the day I entered the hospital. I was never told about any financial or material support. In other words, the pressure that they put on me was to say that there was no way I could support the child, and it's true, I didn't have a job, I didn't have money, I had no family support, you know, but I wasn't thinking that far. I was only 15. But when I realised when I read the transcripts of evidence of the parliamentary inquiry in 1998, and I realised that Gough Whitlam didn't introduce the supporting parent benefit, as many people believed he did in 1973, all he did was change the name from the widow's pension and make it a universal Commonwealth benefit. That support for unwed mothers was always available and had been available since 1939, but it was kept hidden. And, of course, by keeping that financial support hidden, it made it very easy to bludgeon those young unmarried women into giving up their children. I mean, what responsible mother would take the child out into the world knowing that, you know, she would at best have to prostitute herself to keep that child? There was no support for her. Of course, you would be prepared to give the child to a loving married couple and hope that the child would have a better life than you could provide. And this is what was so wrong, that when I found out that support was always available and kept hidden, I just blew my stack. And that's what I wanted to expose, because that was the real crime. Mm.
Do you think, despite all the changes over the years, the government child protection policy often still gets it so very wrong in many cases? Well, Arnie Kate is joining us very, very shortly. We're just having a few technical issues. Certainly fantastic interview, and she's certainly got a lot to tell, a big tale to tell. If nobody has seen her book, please do check it out on Amazon.com or find it online. The book is called 10 Hail Marys, and her latest book, which was released on the 25th of March in 2015, is called Settling Day. It's an amazing book, and it covers a lot of Australian history and a lot of what she experienced growing up in Australia. And I'm certainly so glad that we've had the opportunity to talk to Kate Howarth, and we're certainly going to try and get her back online right here on the People Speak. Welcome back to People Speak Radio Show. We'll be back very, very shortly after this short message break. Welcome back to the People Speak Radio Show with your host, Steve Johnson. We have a very special guest today, an Australian author, Kate Howarth, who has amazing books. They're available on Amazon.com. Do check it out. And we're continuing with the questions here. Welcome back there, Kate Howarth, ma'am.
Thank you, Steve. I'm sorry about the interference. We've got a very high wind blowing here today, and I think it keeps knocking my connection out. So, yeah, I think we'll solve it now.
I wouldn't be surprised. It's the government trying to shut you up.
Wouldn't be the first time.
Do you think with all the years of change, despite all the years of change throughout the years, the government child protection policy often still gets it so very wrong in many cases?
Well, that's evident, isn't it? You only need to flick on the news and see how many children are being, left in rather desperate situations where women, you know, the domestic violence situation and of violence and abuse against children in this country is out of control. It's epidemic. So that is all linked into the ineffectiveness of the services that are available to men and women in those situations. So I couldn't agree more. There isn't enough priority given to making sure that the support mechanism, you know, it's better than it was, obviously. There were no child support services when I was a kid. There was a child welfare department, but they weren't really about helping families keep children. Our institutions were overflowing back in the 50s and 60s with children who had been removed from their homes rather than trying to find, you know, good solutions to keep the family together and help the family support the children. But yes, there's a lot of improvement still, a lot of room for improvement, Steve, for sure.
And one thing I find in a lot of cases, the Department of Child Protection, they seem to have an agenda where the truth doesn't really matter to them as long as they get their way. Is that not true?
Well, I don't want to make criticisms about things that I'm not involved in, but I can tell you from my experience as an unwed mother that the Child Welfare Department were complicit in holding information back from unwed mothers. And this is why Julia Gillard, the then Prime Minister of Australia, when it was exposed just how involved the Child Welfare Department were in these heinous practices, which was really baby trafficking, it was baby farming, they were selling the children. When it was discovered, you know, how prevalent the Child Welfare Department was in keeping that information back, the government had to virtually apologise for their involvement and that oversight. So there's always been something very wrong with those departments, and I don't know, I don't work in them, but I've certainly experienced, you know, firsthand their incompetence.
Yeah, what they're truly up to.
Mm. Mm.
But we do have a question from an audience listener, Mike Forever in Liverpool. Kate, do you think the Port Arthur massacre was an inside job to perpetuate even more injustices on the Australian people?
No, I don't believe it was an inside job. I think Michael Brandt was a lone operator who had a grudge, who had a gun, and had some mental disturbances, and just but the aftermath of that, the knee-jerk reaction by the government to take away the guns, yes, I think that they cashed in on that. I think that was just opportunism at the time, but no, I don't think it was an inside job.
And of course, Martin Bryant is still doing time in Tasmania even today as we speak.
Yes, well, I wasn't too deeply involved in all the aspects of that case. My life was, you know, involved in, you've read my books. I really didn't have time for too much activism back then. But nevertheless, of what I read and what I knew of that incident, no, I don't see a conspiracy theory in that. Others do, I know, that have investigated it more, and I'm not going to criticise them because they've investigated it more deeply than I have, and perhaps if I had all of the information they had, then I might consider that to be so. But from just the information that I have concerning the Port Arthur massacre, I don't personally see any government conspiracy in there. I think it's an easy link to make when we saw what the government did. But we saw what they did with the Babies Overboard affair. We see how, you know, the Little Children a Sacred report. You know, that report was never written to go in and steamroll into Northern Territory Aboriginal communities and garnish your wages and garnish your welfare payments. But that was the knee-jerk reaction of the Howard government. But that's not why that report was done by Auntie Pat. You know, it was done to actually get help out there. So governments are very clever at very quick to jump on issues and make them wedge politics issues.
With so many awful things that I read throughout your book that I read, it was really and truly a small joy to me personally to read towards the end. So many people around your circles were asking for forgiveness towards the end of the book. Do you think this book is ultimately about that closure, that we all seek to right the wrongs over the years despite all that went on?
Well, Settling Day, as the title, you're talking now about Settling Day, not so much 10 Hail Marys. Yes, there was a lot of guilt around things that were done to me as a child and adults that lived long enough to be not so much confronted, because I never saw a need to confront anyone, but my very survival and the fact that my son and I were eventually reunited and I had a successful life and so on, you know, some carried a burden of guilt. over things that had happened to me as a child and wanted to be, you know, forgiven for it. And, you know, forgiveness, I think, is a very important quality to find, you know, your ability to forgive people for wrongdoing if they come to you and even if they don't come to you, just find it in your heart. So Settling Day, as the name implies, isn't about settling scores. It was a personal settling day for me to, you know, put to bed issues of the past, to reconcile with that past, to have a greater understanding of who I am as a person. And in fact, Settling Day is a love story. If you really look at it closely, it's a love story about the enduring love of a mother for her son and her children, and vice versa. And then all of the things that can come into play in between time. But as you know, and I'm not going to spoil it for the readers, but at the end of the book, mm-hmm. it's very evident that the settling day comes for me at the end of the book. And and now that part of my life is dealt with, done with. I hold no bitterness, no resentment. I don't look back. You know, it's not a sackcloth and ashes book. I hope that you got a good few laughs out of it, Steve. I hope I made you laugh out loud at times. I know I have done other people. And they said, I found myself laughing at the most inappropriate times. Well, that's what you have to do, isn't it? You have to be able to laugh at the absurd to get through life. And I think if you can do that, you're going to survive.
Well, what kept me chuckling through it was that the fact that it was so Australian. It was so down to earth and gritty and Australian. We do have a caller on the line here. We got Mike coming to us live from the USA. There, Mike.
Yes, I had a question. A very good interview, despite the sound issues sometimes, but I had a question for Kate. Kate, I was wondering, have you been religious, or has your experience made you in any way more religious or spiritual? Because it sounds like you drew some strength from somewhere. I was just wondering what gave you support and strength through all of this, if there was any religion or spirituality involved. Thank you.
Well, certainly there was as a child, as the name Ten Hail Marys implies. You know, you'll know, having read the book, Steve, that when I was a child, I had a very strong belief in ethereal spirit with me, a guardian angel. And my Uncle Stan, who, of course, was a devout Catholic, he was my godfather and took that very seriously. And I went to church with him, and I made my first communion. And, I was not a devout Catholic, but I certainly believed in God, and I believed in prayer, and I believed in the power of prayer. And strangely enough, people can scoff it, but I can remember times in my life where all I've had was prayer, and certainly in 10 Hail Marys, as you know, Steve, in the hospital there, I literally get down on my knees. I'm bleeding, you know, profusely, but I get down on my knees and I pray all night in a pool of blood. And I say the 10 Hail Marys over and over again, because it seemed that that was the only person that was, you know, something from above, something external, something unrelated to that hospital and the people that had me in their power and control. I wasn't going to get help from them. And then, of course, when I find myself in a terribly desperate situation when I'm 17 and I'm looking down the barrel of having to, you know, be separated from my son even for a day, I remember the day that my faith, my belief left me, and I said, no, there can't be a God. And, of course, then the next book is about finding that spirituality again, finding that hope, finding that that purpose. But, no, I'm not a religious person, but nor am I an atheist, you know. I do have an experience, and I won't even say it's a belief, but I've had experiences that tell me I cannot deny that prayer has worked for me. Now, people can say, oh, that's coincidence, and you can talk that up the yin-yang about science and so on and so on, but all I can say is that there have been times when I've had nothing but prayer to help me out, and it's somehow turned things around. So I'd be untrue to myself if I didn't admit that, even at the risk of appearing wacky to my atheist friends, and I have a few.
And despite your Catholic upbringing, there's one part in the book that really struck me, where you talk about hearing the sounds of a dear departed family member just recently. Can you tell us that? Was that the sounds of a ghost that you actually heard?
Not recently. I mean, I've recently been involved in sorry business here, the passing of my partner early in the year, which is not dealt with in the book. Bruce is mentioned in the back of the book, but he hadn't actually passed away at that time. He passed just a week or two or three weeks before the book was published. So it was that was a terribly trying time for me. At the publication of my last book, because I had just recently lost my partner. But I had experience where I had, contact, if you like, and people can – I can't explain it. It's in the book where I do have contact with a deceased relative that I didn't know had passed. I had no way of knowing that she had passed, and I was being told by this woman that I'm talking to my deceased Aunt Daphne, and I'm thinking, gee, you know, I didn't even know Daphne was dead. So that takes me then on a journey to find out whether or not Auntie Daphne had in fact passed away, and in the way I was told she did, in this sort of session, if you like, with this spiritual person. And it was at a circle, like a seance, if you like, and I was being told that Auntie Daphne was talking to me. And, of course, I'm finding that all very incredulous because I'm thinking, well, no, really, how can this be so? And so that takes me on a journey then, and that reconnects me with my family. And so it was an extraordinary experience. And again, a friend of mine, another atheist, said, oh, you can't put that in the book, Kate. People think you're stark raving mad. And I said, well, they can think what they like. This is what happened. And I can't deny it just because someone will think I'm foolish or I'm pulling their leg or whatever. And I know there are plenty of people out there who've had similar – I'm not unique in that regard. I'm sure there are plenty of people who have had contact with people that are known to be deceased. And, of course, being an Aboriginal woman, we do – and any religious person shouldn't have a problem with communicating with the deceased, because let's face it, they do subscribe to a spirit, they do subscribe to eternal life, they do subscribe to a soul. And so, you know, what makes it, you know, incredulous that that soul could then reconnect and talk to someone who's still living? I don't have the difficulty in understanding that, because I have experienced it.
Yeah, wow. You know, today in 2015, people are used to calling the Indigenous of Australia Aboriginals. However, myself, knowing the semiotics and semantics of language, I prefer to call the Australian natives the originals rather than the Aboriginals. Do you think that's a more descriptive term?
Well, if you listen to Auntie Ruth, Rosalie Kernuth Monks, she said it really well. I am not Aboriginal. Indeed, I am not Indigenous. I am Arente. Wathaurul woman. I'm not Aboriginal, Steve. I am not Indigenous. I am Wiradjuri Wanarua woman. So, you see, our nations are known. And Aboriginal and Indigenous, they are terms that have been used to describe a people which are not homogenous. You know, we are not one group. And it is wrong to group us in, but it's been done for convenience. And now it's a sort of a common, but there are more and more groups who, you know, are still very strong in their language, and Wiradjuri are one of them, and certainly the Arente, where Auntie Rosalie is from. If you know your tribal group, you will respond by saying you're in the same way that a Native American person won't call themselves a Native American when they're being spoken to. They'll say where they're from, who their band or tribe is.
Yes, so they'll identify that we are the Sioux or we are the
exactly.
Iroquois.
Exactly, and we're not used to that. So that is such a, you know, bearing in mind, Steve, it's only just over 40 years that Aboriginal people have even been recognised as citizens in this country. So many Australians would not be able to list even maybe five Aboriginal tribal groups. They wouldn't. The average Australian wouldn't be able to do that. They wouldn't know what that is, because it's still very new in the vernacular.
Yeah. We have a question from an audience member. Frank in St. Louis would like to know, do you think the Catholic Church and the current Pope are worth supporting in the aftermath of this life experience?
Well, I've never supported the Pope, and I've never supported the Catholic Church.
That the Pope is just a stooge? You really believe that? I certainly do. Many people have loved to listen to Arnie Kate, and you can certainly check her stuff out. We will be having her on again, because indeed we seem to be having a few technical issues. The weather's against us, the Mercury retrograde, And of course, communications always having a few problems every time this happens. There is a Mercury retrograde. And we will certainly be asking her some more questions. I've got a whole bunch of questions I would love to ask her all about 9/11. I would like to ask her about her personal political views and how it's changed her. And I would certainly love to read more about the book to the people and certainly her story. In January of 1966, the author here, Kate Howarth, she gave birth to a healthy baby boy in St. Margaret's Home for Unwed Mothers in Sydney. In the months before the birth and days after, she resisted the intense pressure to give up her son for adoption, becoming one of the few women ever to leave the institution with her baby. And she was only 16 years old at the time. What I would like to know, what we would all like to find out, is what inspired such courage. That's the interesting thing. In her first book, Ten Hail Marys, Kate Howarth vividly recounts the first 17 years of her life in Sydney slums and the suburbs in rural New South Wales in Australia. And of course, her life growing up in Western Sydney in the Western suburbs around Parramatta and of course, Blacktown. Fantastic place to grow up, that's for sure. Kate Howarth was shunted between Aboriginal relatives, I should say Indigenous or original relatives, and expected to grow up faster than she should have. She's a natural storyteller, she's an Australian icon, and she describes a childhood beset by hardship, abuse, profound grief, and poverty, but cemented with the hope that one day she would make a better life for herself. It is a frank, funny, and incredibly moving story. Ten Hail Marys, her first book, is a compelling, true story of a childhood lost and a young woman's hard-won self-possession. We move then on to her second book, and of course that was released just this year on March in 2015. Her second book is, of course, the sequel to her first book, the sequel being called Settling Day, where this story, the second book, tells of how she was thrust out of her son's life while he was still a toddler, and teenage Kate has to rely on her wits and courage to start her life anew. Filled with remorse and unwavering determination to be reunited with her son, so begins Kate's journey as she fights injustice and prejudice to create a better life. She amasses a fortune helping to build one of Australia's most successful recruitment companies, only to lose it all in a legal battle. Once again, in the second book, she manages to rebuild her life after a major injury, but is always haunted by her lost son. And of course, we'll be having Kate Howarth on again so we can finish this interview. And of course, I still have a lot more questions I want to ask her. I still have a lot more things I'd like to get through. And of course, I'd like to ask about her political stances and what she feels about that. My gosh, I've at least got another 20, 30 questions I didn't get to answer, that I didn't get to get an answer from. But of course, just as always, you're listening to the People Speak Radio show on the BBS Radio Network, where we have some of the best guests, some of the live interviews, and anything can happen. When it's a live radio, you never know what's going to happen. But you have been listening right here to the People Speak Radio show with author Kate Howarth. I'd like to thank her and remind her and all the listeners to look out for her two books on Amazon. Thanks very much for being on the show today, Auntie Kate, ma'am. And join us. Join us all coming up on the People Speak Radio show very, very soon when we will have very special guests Ken O'Keefe and David Ray Griffin. Ken O'Keefe will be coming to us live and direct from the People Speak Radio show. And, of course, you can listen to him on the BBS Radio Network next Tuesday from between 9 and 10 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time. Right here, stay tuned for those interviews coming up soon. Big thanks go out to the producers, Mike, Doug, and Donald, and to all my friends around the world and to all the guys who have given me so much support. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. You can tune in to my own channel called Stop Funding Israel on YouTube. But for me, for now, take care and bye until next time.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island. forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.